WikiLeaks. We have evidence of the crimes they committed. Julian Assange, even though he is not a U.S. citizen and his WikiLeaks site is not a U.S.-based publication, is charged under the U.S. Espionage Act for making public numerous war crimes. Assange, currently housed in a high-security prison in London, is fighting a losing battle in the British courts to block his extradition to the United States, where he faces 175 years in prison. We must demand justice for those who were wounded, became sick, or died because the United States destroyed hospitals and infrastructure. We must demand justice for the 38 million people who have been displaced or become refugees in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, the Philippines, Libya, and Syria, a number that exceeds the total of all those displaced in all wars since 1900. Apart from the Second World War, according to the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University. Every effort to hold American war criminals accountable has been rebuffed by Congress, by the courts, by the media, and by two ruling political parties. The Center for Constitutional Rights, blocked by bringing cases in the U.S. courts against the architects of these preemptive wars, which are defined by post-Nuremberg laws as criminal wars of aggression, filed motions in German courts to hold U.S. leaders to account for gross violations of the Geneva Convention, including the sanctioning of torture in black sites such as Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. Why weren't sanctions imposed on the United States of America? Why weren't those who defended their countries from foreign invasion in the West Asia, North Africa region, including Palestinians under Israeli regime occupation, also provided with thousands of anti-tank weapons, anti-armor weapons, anti-aircraft weapons, helicopters, switchblade or kamikaze drones, hundreds of Stinger anti-aircraft systems, Javelin anti-tank missiles, machine guns, and millions of rounds of ammunition? Well, we know why. U.S. war crimes don't count, and neither do the victims for the U.S. war crimes. And this hypocrisy makes a rules-based world, one that abides by international law, impossible. This hypocrisy is not new. Mass death and fireballs on a city skyline are the calling cards Americans have left across the globe for decades. The deliberate targeting of civilians, whether in Baghdad, Gaza, or New York City, are all American war crimes. So is the killing of 230,000 people over the past 7 years in Yemen, from Saudi bombing campaigns and blockades that have resulted in mass starvation and cholera epidemics. Where were the calls for a no-fly zone over Gaza and Yemen? Imagine how many lives could have been saved. War crimes demand the same moral judgment and accountability, but they don't get them. And they don't get them because Americans have one set of standards for white Europeans and another for non-white people around the globe. The Second World War began with an understanding, at least by the Allies, that employing industrial weapons against civilian populations was a war crime. But within 18 months of the start of the war, the Germans, Americans, and British were relentlessly bombing cities. By the end of the war, one-fifth of German homes had been destroyed. 1 million German civilians were killed or wounded in bombing raids. 7.5 million Germans were made homeless. The tactic of saturation bombing or area bombing, which included the firebombing of Dresden, Hamburg, and Tokyo, which killed more than 90,000 Japanese civilians in Tokyo and left a million people homeless, and the dropping of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which took the lives of between 129,000 and 226,000 people, most of whom were civilians, and the sole purpose of breaking the morale of the population through mass death and terror. It turned the architects of modern war and all of them into war criminals. Civilians in every war since have been considered legitimate targets. In the summer of 1965, then-Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara called the bombing raids north of Saigon that left hundreds of thousands of dead an effective means of communication with the government in Hanoi. McNamara, 6 years before he died, unlike most war criminals, had the capacity for self-reflection. Interviewed in the documentary The Fog of War, he was repentant, not only about targeting Vietnamese civilians, but about the aerial targeting of civilians in Japan in the Second World War, overseen by Air Force General Curtis LeMay. LeMay said, if we'd lost the war, we'd all have been prosecuted as war criminals, McNamara said in the film, adding, and I think he's right. LeMay recognized that what he was doing would be thought immoral if his side had lost. But what makes it immoral if you lose and not immoral if you win? Industrial killing defines modern warfare. It is impersonal mass slaughter. It is administered by vast bureaucratic structures that perpetuate the killing over months and years. It is sustained by heavy industry that produces a steady flow of weapons, munitions, tanks, planes, helicopters, battleships, submarines, missiles, and mass-produced supplies, along with mechanized transports that ferry troops and armaments by rail, ship, cargo planes, and trucks to the battlefield. It mobilizes industrial, governmental, and organizational structures for total war. It centralizes systems of information and internal control. It is rationalized for the public by specialists and experts drawn from the military establishment, along with pliant academics and the media. Industrial war destroys existing value systems that protect and nurture life, replacing them with fear, hatred, and dehumanization of those who are made to believe deserve to be exterminated. It is driven by emotions, not truth or fact. It obliterates nuisance, replacing it with an infantile binary universe of Americans and them. It drives competing narratives, ideas, and values underground and vilifies all who do not speak in the national cant that replaces civil discourse and debate. It is touted as an example of the inevitable march of human progress, when in fact it brings Americans closer and closer to mass obliteration and nuclear catastrophe. It mocks the concept of individual heroism despite the feverish efforts of the military and the mass media to sell this myth, this legend, to naive young recruits and a gullible public. Of course, there will be no prosecution of Saudi Arabian rulers for the war crimes committed in Yemen or for the U.S. military and political leadership for the war crimes they carried out in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, or a generation earlier in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. The atrocities Americans commit, such as My Lai, where 500 unarmed Vietnamese civilians were gunned down by U.S. troops, which are made public, are dealt with by finding a scapegoat, usually a low-ranking officer who is given a symbolic sentence. Lieutenant William Kelly served 3 years under house arrest for the killing of At My Lai. 11 U.S. troops, none of whom were officers, were convicted of torture at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. But the architects and the overlords of U.S. industrial slaughter, including Franklin Roosevelt, Winston Churchill, General Curtis LeMay, Harry S. Truman, Richard Nixon, Henry Kissinger, Lyndon Johnson, General William Westmoreland, George W. Bush, General David Petraeus, Barack Obama, and Joe Biden are never held to account. They leave power to become venerated elder statesmen. The mass slaughter of industrial warfare, the failure to hold Americans to account, to see American face in the war criminals they condemn, will have ominous consequences. Politicians and generals wield their destructive fury as if they were toys. Those who decry the madness, who demand the rule of law, are attacked and condemned. These industrial weapon systems are U.S. modern idols. Midstream.
Despite the surrender of a large number of Arab regimes today before the Zionist entity, where some of them go as far as allying themselves with it, Israel is still the enemy of the peoples of the region, just as it is the enemy of Palestine. The rejection of the greater part of the Arab peoples, and with them the peoples of the Islamic world, to this unholy alliance, and their support for the option of resistance, as the Battle of the Sword of Al-Quds made clear, is among the hard facts that the Western and Persian Gulf propaganda apparatuses could not deny. Palestine does not concern Muslims alone. It is the cause of a people resisting settler colonialism that falls within the framework of the strategy of Western hegemony over the Arab and Islamic region. Solidarity and even identification on a global scale with the people of Palestine is due to the fact that their cause summarizes and intensifies all the major political issues still pending around the globe. In addition to being a resistance to the latest form of settler colonialism, it also includes a struggle against discrimination and apartheid practiced by the Zionist entity, and a confrontation with the policies of hegemony and war adopted by the Western imperialist powers against the global South. Meanwhile, in the Arab world, attacks and pressure against the axis of resistance escalated, coinciding with the escalation of the pace of official Arab normalization, which reached the point of an alliance between the Zionist entity and the normalized Arab states, especially the UAE and Bahrain. The official Arab position that supports the Palestinian people, albeit verbally, is absent in the face of the daily Zionist aggression at the hands of the occupation army and its settlers. Photos of Arab officials in Tel Aviv and of Zionist officials in Arab capitals indicated that the horizon of Arab support for the struggle of the Palestinian people has been blocked. With the beginning of 2022, the wave of normalization escalated through the Arab-Israeli summits in Abu Dhabi, Manama, Sharm el-Sheikh, Amman, and the Negev. However, at the level of the people, the struggle was still in full gear. March and April 2022 brought about Israeli fears like never before, with unorganized lone resistance operations that targeted the internal occupied territories, which Israel views as its secure fortress. Not anymore. With the beginning of the month of Ramadan, popular protests erupted in most Palestinian cities. The title of this new confrontation was to protect the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which the settlers announced their intention to storm and make sacrifices in its squares, while Gaza made way for limited but accurate missile retaliations towards Israel. The comprehensiveness and continuity of the confrontation raised the question, Is an all-inclusive Palestinian intifada approaching? Well, we'll have to see about that, although I truly hope to be part of that one day. Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Is the targeting of the Zionist colonial project of Al-Aqsa Mosque, the first of the two Qiblas and the third of the two holy mosques, and the Holy Church of the Sepulchre establishing a religious war with Muslims and Christians that might ignite a comprehensive revolution in Palestine? The substitutionary colonial projects are not satisfied with killing, displacing, and annihilating the indigenous population. Zionism also seeks to erase their material, moral, and cultural impact, or to seize it if possible, and to include it in its historical and cultural narrative. However, despite the difficulties imposed by the position of the Ramallah Authority and the Arab complicity against the Palestinians, several factors on the ground indicate a comprehensive Palestinian uprising in Al-Quds, the West Bank, and the 1948 occupied territories. It is closer than ever. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Danielle Yagic, academic and political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us. Danielle, now, Muslims and Christians across the world have been witnessing live on social media how the Zionist entity have been harassing and kidnapping and violently stopping worshippers from entering both Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. How do you think these acts of aggression will basically resonate within the Palestinian communities, whether it is in the occupied territories or maybe also in the Gaza Strip?
Of course, these latest forms of the Zionist violence against Palestinian worshippers of all religions that are present in Palestine may, of course, trigger responses, because eventually what the Zionist regime has been doing in the last days has been attacking the indigenous people, including Muslims and Christians, on their holy holidays and at their holy sites where they were practicing their religion. This shows, however, at the same time, the desperation of the Zionist regime, because even after decades of genocidal erasure that the Zionist regime has been attempting to commit in Palestine, eventually, the overlap, as we see these days during the holy month of Ramadan and the Easter celebrations, reveal again that the Palestinians are still there. They are on their indigenous land, and they are practicing their customs, beliefs, and their culture. And this very much really destabilizes, again, the Zionist notion of the takeover of the land. So in many ways, the latest forms of violence that we've seen and that were audiovisually captured and documented and went viral worldwide show once again the frustration of the Zionist regime that the erasure is yet continuing in the settler colonial mechanism. And of course, there are going to be reactions, but effectively, this is part of a systematic and structural form of violence than a colonial war that the Zionists eventually cannot win, because the indigenous population is still there, is surviving, and continues to resist.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's interesting for me is I see the increase in the confidence in the Palestinians, especially in the West Bank, where in themselves and in their capabilities. Definitely after the series of guerrilla operations that we saw hitting what Israel considers as its own security fortress inside its colonial settlers' capital. It is raising concerns inside the Israeli cabinet, which why we saw them doing some sort of a limited incursion into the Jenin camp recently, and it was bad, a result bad for them. But will the occupation maybe resort to a similar incursion to the West Bank, maybe in his own mind, to prevent any further uprising of the Palestinian natives in the West Bank?
It's a good question, because it shows this dilemma of the Zionist entity, where on the one hand, it cannot survive without violence. If the Zionist entity would not be oppressing and killing Palestinians and dispossessing them and seizing their land, it would not exist, because the entire idea of the Zionist entity as such is based on these apartheid structures that necessitate violence. So any lack of violence from the side of the Zionist regime would effectively lead to the dismantling of the Zionist regime. Now, at the same time, of course, the Zionist regime is of course also on alert of any potential retaliations from Palestinians. And I think the situation that we've seen last year in May 2021 where there was a similar situation as today during the holy month of Ramadan, and in which the Palestinian resistance has showed their new capabilities of targeting and retaliating by targeting colonies within the 1948 territories. So the Zionist entity is confronted with this dilemma, and effectively this is also where potential ways towards liberation lie, because any cease of violence would lead to the destruction of the apartheid regime, because it can only uphold itself on these injustices and the actual physical violence. But this cannot happen without reactions from the indigenous people. I'd also just like to add that the mere fact that indigenous people exist and basically just remain on their land is the major threat to the colonial regime. And by viewing the actual situation from that perspective, I think really reveals once more the fragility of the Zionist regime.
Well, Palestinians live daily through obstruction at the level of the political action, whether it is from the Ramallah Authority or from the normalization, the wave of normalization that has hit the region of West Asia, maybe as well in the different stages of confrontation with the Zionist entity. Now, a feeling of necessity to take their fate into their own hands has culminated within the Palestinian communities. But is it fair to suggest that the Palestinians be left to their own fate? I mean, even though with their legendary resistance operation, what I mean here, if there is a comprehensive revolution to be started in Palestine, what will be the role of the surrounding of Palestine?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to some extent, I think Palestinians have been, there have been attempts internationally to isolate Palestinians, to isolate their struggle, especially, of course, not only by the Israeli regime, but maybe to a larger extent, even more so by its backers, the European Union, United States, and what is generally referred to as the so-called international community, in which there have been attempts rhetorically to portray the Palestinian cause as a diplomatic conflict, allegedly, or as an isolated incident. And however, of course, it is a transnational issue, and Palestinians have been continuing to resist. There have been uprisings. We've seen different episodes of different intifadas in which Palestinians went to the streets and continued to really dismantle those colonial structures, to which, as a reaction, the Zionist regime had to come up time and time again with new and more sophisticated forms of control and containment. So Palestinians have continued to resist and continue to do so, and doing so posed a major challenge to the existence of the Zionist enemy. Now, at the same time, of course, the mere fact that the Zionist entity is still existing in its forms is mostly due to the foreign backing that it receives from the United States and European Union in particular, and then recently, of course, more diplomatically from Arab regimes in the Persian Gulf. Mm-hmm. And of course, if that support were to be withdrawn, a situation would be different. But even within this so-called international community, I mean, in this system that is so flawed, there is still the Palestinian right to armed resistance, as the UN resolutions that guarantee people under occupation the right to resist and to use any forms or any means at their disposal against the foreign occupation. And another point I would like to address is the fact that the Zionist occupation colonization has been transnational in its core. It has targeted mm-hmm. Syria, it has targeted Lebanon, it has targeted populations outside of historic Palestine. And so as such, the response and the resistance against the colonial regime has been a transnational one all along.
Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't really seem going very well for the Zionist entity at the moment. We'll have to wait and see what happens next. I want to thank you very much, Daniel Yagich, academic and political commentator, for joining us to talk about this very crucial matter at the time being. Please stay tuned, because next we'll be talking how Saudi Arabia has no way to win that war in Yemen.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
indicators lead to pessimism about the persistence of the UN-sponsored humanitarian truce in Yemen after a third of the period has passed without any significant military and humanitarian progress amid erosion of Sana'a's confidence in the possibility of the coalition of aggression and the United Nations fulfilling their obligations. Commenting on the ongoing war in Yemen, leader of the Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei criticized Saudi Arabia's intervention in Yemen, asking Saudi Arabia to cease its aggression and involvement in Yemen, emphasizing that this comment comes out of goodwill towards the Gulf Kingdom. No possibility of Saudi victory in Yemen in this following report.
As Saudi Arabia continues to play a key role in influencing neighboring Yemen's political future, the kingdom's main regional rival, Iran, has maintained its place on the other side of the equation in support of the Yemeni people in the face of the Saudi war machine. Leader of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, criticized Saudi Arabia's constant aggression on Yemen during a Ramadan ceremony in Tehran. Sayyid Khamenei asked Saudi Arabia to cease its aggression on Yemen, saying he made the comments out of goodwill towards the kingdom. "I have a word for the Saudis, and I give this counsel out of goodwill for them. Why are you continuing a war you're certain you won't win? Find a way out of this war." Sayyid Khamenei then asked, "Is there even a possibility that the Saudis would win the war in Yemen?" "There's no possibility. With the endeavors, initiative, and courage of the Yemeni people and leaders, there's no possibility of you winning." If the truce is truly implemented, Khamenei added, it can be extended and the people of Yemen can prevail through the efforts, bravery, and initiative of themselves and their leaders. Sayyid Khamenei's remarks follow ongoing talks between Iran and Saudi Arabia. About a year ago, the two sides began a dialogue in Baghdad aimed at reducing tensions. It's not a secret that the two countries have a variety of disagreements, and not just on Yemen. Saudi Arabia also vocally opposes Iran's nuclear development, as well as the Islamic Republic's support of the Lebanese resistance group Hezbollah. Iran is against the repression of Shia Muslims in Saudi Arabia, the absurd Saudi war on Yemen, and the Saudi attempt to normalize ties with the region's main enemy, Israel. The talks made considerable progress last year, according to officials. Last October, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian said the deliberations had advanced a good distance. On April 25th, Iran said that the latest round of talks with Saudi Arabia was positive and serious and voiced hope for further progress soon. The latest talks were reportedly attended by senior officials from the Secretariat of Iran's Supreme National Security Council and the head of the Saudi Intelligence Service, as foreign ministers of the two countries are expected to meet in the near future. In the meantime, Iran's position on an eventual peace process in Yemen has been consistent since the first day of the Saudi war on Yemen. Whether or not the current Iranian-Saudi talks would convince the Saudi side to maintain peace in Yemen is yet to be seen, as Sana'a announced last week that the Saudi-led coalition is halting the peace process and evading its commitments to facilitating travels at Sana'a International Airport and allowing oil derivatives to enter the country by sea.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Tehran is Dr. Hamid Razab, Deputy Mayor of Tehran for International Affairs and a political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Hamid. Now, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei's comments about Saudi Arabia having zero possibility to win the war against Yemen came in a form of a friendly remark. While asking the Saudis, and I quote, "I give this counsel out of goodwill. Why are you continuing a war you're certain you won't win? Just find a way out of this war." Was this a form of an argument against the Saudi logic about this war, rather a message that the leader is conveying to the regime of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia?
First of all, thank you very much for having me. The point is that this comment is just out of common sense. It's clear that a war that was supposed to be won in 3 weeks and is lasting for several years is not going to be won by the Saudis anymore. So it is just pure common sense and pure reason, actually. So if the Saudis are not reaching that resolve or that argument is something that they are falling about that. No, the point is that what Ayatollah Khamenei said is that this war is not going to be won by any means by the Saudis and all the situations on the ground. Besides, let's just put aside the propaganda machine and the media outcomes. The reality on the ground of the battlefield is showing us that the Yemenis have a good situation in that war, and the Saudis are not going to win anymore. And if it continues anymore, that would be more damage to the Saudis. And Iran does not want an important country in the region to be destroyed anymore, to have more casualties among the citizens, to have more damages to the region, because any damage to the region, any discord in the region, has one winner, and that is the Westerners, the Zionists in the occupied Palestine. And they are winning the war here in between. And the Saudis are just some puppet regime that are just serving the interests of those regimes in the West, mm-hmm. and, of course, in the occupied Palestine. So it is just a reality that was reiterated to the Saudis.
Well, we do know that Iran and Saudi Arabia are conducting talks at the moment, negotiations, let's say. But Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei said that even though the truce in Yemen is an agreement written on a paper, it is still very good to stop the war, even if for 2 months. And he would love it, and he would appreciate it if it continued further, reiterating that the Yemeni people is a patient people, although they are deeply oppressed by this war. Now, if Saudi Arabia decides to continue after the truce ends, and they decide to continue further with that war, would that interrupt the ongoing negotiations between Iran and Saudi Arabia?
Iran sees Yemen as a sovereign country, and the Yemen resistance is a sovereign state, and Iran is not going to interfere in that. Iran is supporting the Houthis and the Yemenis in that war, but it doesn't mean that Iran is going to decide for them or to consider any involvement there in its own politics. So the negotiations, which is based on the goodwill of Iran in good neighborliness, and in which Iran is trying to seek some better relationship with another Muslim country in the region, a neighboring country, doesn't have anything to do with other issues in other areas. If the Saudis or other Arab countries are actually adhering to that so-called Abrahamic peace accord with the Zionist regime, and we know that how hostile the Zionists are toward Iran, but Iran is not going to consider that as a part of the negotiation. The point is that Iran is seeing negotiations as a ground to be closer to the countries in the region and to keep them closer and not to push them away to get in line with other countries that are not in the region, or other regimes that are actually sowing discord to benefit for their own. So I don't think that Iran is going to decide for the war in Yemen or to want to use it as a bargaining chip in the negotiations with the Saudis. Iran is respecting the Yemenis and is supporting the peace or ceasefire in that region. But I don't think that if the ceasefire is actually broken or the Saudis continue the war, Iran would stop the negotiations that it has directly with the Saudis.
Well, it was clear, to be honest with you, from the day the truce was announced that the coalition of aggression had no serious or sincere intentions to enforce it in Yemen as a first step to building confidence, by the way, in order to build up for more peace. But I refuse to believe that the UN truly has no power to oblige the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to adhere to the terms of this truce that it has already committed itself to. Then why are they lagging on this? Why are they allowing the airport to be open and the port to be open for at least the oil derivatives for the people not to suffocate in Yemen?
First of all, I do agree that it was clear actually from day one that the Saudis are not going to adhere to the ceasefire. And they are looking at it just as a breaking point to have less attack from the Yemeni side. It was a resting point for the Saudis actually, and to attack the Yemenis, because they know that the Yemenis are going to keep the promise. Regarding the United Nations, it's nothing new that they are very inactive. And let's just remember that for the same Saudis, they paid the UN to remove the Saudi Arabia from the list of the child-killing regimes in just a few years ago. And it was exactly because of the war in Yemen that they were put in that list. So the United Nations is easily bought by money or by politics or by, pressure from some Western countries. So we cannot expect the United Nations to take any considerable and real measures or steps toward keeping that ceasefire, because they don't have the power to, and they don't have the will to interfere in such things. And this inactivity through all these years and decades has made it something, let's say, ceremonial and ceremonial organization, which is incapable of stopping wars anywhere in the world, especially in places like here, in which Saudi Arabians are using their petrodollars to actually buy the organization, international organizations.
Well, it definitely seemed that the upcoming weeks will bring a lot of development to the Saudi war in Yemen, and it remains to be seen how the Yemenis will react to the ongoing aggression. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Hamid Reza, Deputy Mayor of Tehran, for international affairs and political commentator, for joining us to talk about this crucial matter. I want to thank you very much for being with us, and happy Eid for you, Eid Fitr Sa'id for you and your families, and Ramadan Mubarak for everyone. May next year be a much peaceful year on all the world, on all the globe, in these holy days that we are passing. Thank you very much, and I'll see you next week on the Middle East Stream.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
We are seeing injuries we didn't see before. Pelvic fractures, spinal cord injuries, brain injuries, and a lot of open fractures when the bone comes through the skin, said a San Diego doctor. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jessica Corbett, journalist. This article is published under the heading Absolutely Tragic, Doctors Tie Trump's 30-foot border wall to surge in injuries and deaths. Here's the story. Doctors in Southern California are connecting former President Donald Trump's efforts to build a U.S.-Mexico border wall that can't be climbed with soaring rates of serious injuries and death among migrants. Seven physicians at the University of California, San Diego, detailed new statistics and their observations about local trauma cases in a research letter published recently in the journal JAMA Surgery. Under Trump, a 30-foot wall was installed across more than 400 miles, often replacing shorter barriers. The doctors focused on admissions to their trauma center after the new wall went up in California's Imperial and San Diego counties. Before the higher barrier was built, there were 67 fall admissions from the border wall compared with 375 during and after the period. The letter states, explaining that this increase of more than five times is still significant when doctors factor in average apprehensions by U.S. immigration officials. After the wall was raised, there was also a jump in depth from 0 to 16. Once you go over 20 feet and up to 30 feet, the chance of severe injury and death are higher. Dr. Jay Dossett, chief of the trauma division at UC San Diego Health, told the Washington Post, adding, "We are seeing injuries we didn't see before, pelvic fractures, spinal cord injuries, brain fractures, and a lot of open fractures when the bone comes through the skin." As the newspaper reported, at Scripps Mercy Hospital, the other major trauma center for the San Diego area, border wall fall victims accounted for 16% of the 230 patients treated last month, a higher share than gunshot and stabbing cases, according to Vishal Bansal, the director of trauma. Bansal said in an interview, "I've never seen anything like this. This is crazy." His trauma ward treated 139 border wall patients injured by falls last year, up from 41 in 2020. Hector Almeida, a 33-year-old dentist from Cuba, who was sent to UC San Diego Health after fracturing his left leg, told the Post that, "I never expected we would have to climb the wall." According to the paper, smugglers let his group to the wall with a ladder and told them to climb up and slide down the other side, said Almeida, who said he saw one woman fall and break both legs and an older man with a severe head injury. The San Diego Union-Tribune shared what happened to a Mexican family trying to flee drug cartel violence after they were turned away by U.S. officials under the Title 42 policy while seeking asylum at the San Diego port of entry. On a foggy night in mid-March, several family members from the Mexican state of Michoacán followed the smugglers' instructions to climb the first of the two border barriers to reach U.S. soil near San Diego. One of the women felt her grip slipping on the first fence from the moisture in the air as she struggled over. When she approached the second wall looming 30 feet above her, she realized it would be impossible for her to get over safely. As she panicked, the smugglers told her to wait to the side for Border Patrol to get her so that other migrants could cross. It was only after she reached the Border Patrol station that she learned that her 14-year-old daughter, whom the smugglers sent with an earlier group, had fallen from the 30-foot wall. The woman said, "It was the worst night of my life." The woman, whose daughter remains mostly bedridden after spending a week in the hospital with a fractured skull, neck, and back, added, "We had come to save our lives, not to risk them in such an awful way." Along with the human impact, the rise in falls has taken a financial toll. The letter notes that the increased hospital cost of the surge in admissions exceeded $13 million in 2021. The surge also coincided with the COVID-19 pandemic, which has strained the U.S. healthcare system, the paper points out, adding, "The care of these injured immigrants is not only a humanitarian problem, but also a public health crisis that further worsened trauma center bed capacity, staff shortages, and professionals' moral injury. Most of these patients had significant brain and facial injuries or complex fractures of the extremities or spine, with many requiring intensive care and staged operative reconstructions. Lack of health insurance made most patients ineligible for rehabilitation facilities or post-discharge physical therapy, further lengthening prolonged hospital stays." The letter says that the Title 42 policy, enabling U.S. officials to swiftly expel many migrants like the family from Mekonnen, may have increased the numbers and desperation of persons crossing the border away from ports of entry and increased the number of falls. The Title 42 policy was implemented under Trump and continued under Biden, who plans to end it next month, though some lawmakers are pushing to extend it with a bill that critics say ignores individuals and families in desperate need of safety and the right to seek protection from persecution.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Afghanistan's tumultuous days have stretched on to complete over four decades. With the new Talib rulership, at least 1,000 a day have been fleeing across the country's porous border into Iran since last August. By now, there's no less than 4.5 million Afghans in Iran. This is while even the former statistic of under 3 million included only 600,000 legal Afghan immigrants. The security issue here is clear. There's millions of undocumented, unknown people in this country that is itself sanctioned by the U.S. with a wealth of its own economic hardships. Now safety issues are added, and some fear not just from common crime. After all, the Taliban were an armed guerrilla group that have become an inexperienced Afghan government of what it's calling the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. How Afghans are doing in Iran and what their changing demography will mean for them and for Iran, we will study today. Also, how stability can be secured in Afghanistan so that its people can return to safety, leaving behind an unchallenged Iranian border. Stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. Both sides, Iran and Afghanistan, proclaim brotherhood, so to speak, and say whatever border issues were a misunderstanding or because of the Taliban being new to govern. This, of course, means there has been some tension at the border. And Iranian Parliament or Majlis did call in the Interior Minister, Ahmad Vahidi, for questioning, giving him a chance to probe further into the issue of border security. Mr. Maliki is an MP who served as ambassador to Afghanistan. He spoke of Parliament's probe into the border situation and his experience with ordinary Afghans during his posting to their country.
Following the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan, one of the issues that the National Security Committee, the Parliament, and the Supreme National Security Council began to consider was the Taliban itself, their views, and the developments in this Muslim country, which shares a long history with Iran. It was a natural thing to do. We did so with regard to Pakistan and other countries in the region. But considering the fact that the Taliban came to power with a distinct ideology, the Islamic Republic of Iran was concerned about a possible incident taking place with Afghanistan, especially considering the sheer length of the border with this country.
Meshkini, spokesman for Iranian Parliament's National Security and Foreign Policy Commission, noted that the security situation along Iran's borders is great, given it has one of the most powerful border forces of the region. But all movements in those areas must be carefully monitored all the same. He stressed, the question is if the Taliban rulers of Afghanistan were aware of the movements. Mr. Rajai is an Afghan affairs analyst. He made a trip to Press TV studios to share his views.
Speaking of Iran's policy on Afghanistan, Tehran's sole concern is security and sustainable peace in the country. But unfortunately, the situation in Afghanistan is intensifying every day. That's because of foreign interference. Proxy wars and excessive demands from some neighboring countries have prevented Afghanistan from achieving peace. Look at Afghanistan through the history since Najibullah, we can see that the people of Afghanistan have never experienced absolute peace of mind. There have been ethnic wars, wars between political and jihadi factions that intensified by the day. Genocide has been a reality both back then and right now. All Afghans have been targeted. We can't assume that any ethnicities in Afghanistan, either Pashtuns, Tajiks or Hazara, have been immune to this. They have all been dealing with problems that will result in even more disasters for them every day.
The main border crossing between Iran and Afghanistan was closed last Saturday, April the 23rd, following a brief clash between Iranian border guards and armed men who were said to be Taliban members. The clash happened after Iranian guards prevented the Taliban's local authorities in Afghanistan's Herat province from building a road on the border without coordination with Iranian authorities, IFP reports.
The presence of some Takfiri groups in Afghanistan raised fears. Over the past few weeks, we witnessed adventurism from certain groups on our borders. Our border patrol and army that's been stationed there responded to them. I recently paid a visit to the area and witnessed that. Although the Taliban said they didn't mean anything, the Iranian Foreign Ministry was tasked with contracting the Taliban and addressing the issue to ensure it won't happen again.
Considering water and the right to access the water, they play new tricks every day. They blow hot and cold about giving Iran access and recognizing Iran's right to the waters. We care for the people of Afghanistan more than the water issue. We care about the security of our people, which will be affected by them in the not-so-distant future. If we can't manage the issue, which, by the way, we haven't so far, we'll definitely have to pay for it. We've dealt with the problems from a humanitarian perspective. There have been clashes in the meanwhile. The border clashes have been intentional, and we shouldn't forget them that easily. The video clips and remarks that are being propagated indicate an open animosity. When they kill Shias, they're trying to appease certain groups. They kill people and mourn for them too.
Afghanistan has been thunderstruck. First came the Soviet invasion of 1978 and a Russian military presence going on some 15 years till 1992, years of fighting with Taliban. Less than a decade since, in 2001, the 9/11 Twin Tower explosion served as a pretext for America to attack Afghanistan. That presence went on for 20 years with a division of power with the Taliban. With a U.S. withdrawal finalized end August 2021, the Taliban became the sole rulers of Afghanistan. But they're new. They don't appear to have established a single unified policy, and they are yet to be internationally recognized. Iran won't recognize them unless they include all ethnicities. For the people of Afghanistan, it says, as well as its own security. A Talib Pashtun government alone sounds like it will be less brotherly to Iran than one that includes the Tajiks and Hazaras. The Tajiks speak Tajiki Persian, and Hazaras speak Hazaragi, a dialect of Persian, Persian being the official language of Iran or Persia. For many Afghans, a return home is a dream long lost. They see no choice but to cross over into Iran over a treacherous borderland of over 920 kilometers. The average refugee settles for low-paid, unskilled labor. But there's more than exceptions to the rule. Our trip to slushy suburbs south of Tehran didn't appear inspiring, and so it came as a pleasant surprise to find a wooden furniture factory bazaar on one slushy white dead end. With several mostly Afghan lads putting his furniture together, the bulk of goods in the making tell of one Mr. Yusefi's success story.
I came to this country in 1994. I was in the construction business until around 2003. Then I started working for a company that specialized in this. That's how I got familiar with this job. It was around 2007 that we got a small workshop that was around 80 square meters where we provided various services. For example, we'd paint chairs for a fee. We continued the job and expanded the business to its current size.
The self-fashioned entrepreneur showed me around his two workshops, one for carpentry, the other for finishing, as well as his exhibition warehouse. He was using all grades of wood, but focusing on affordable raw material with a better finish. It's a modest income, he explained, in spite of the bulk of work and production. But I noticed about 12 people in his employ at the time for what he called regular wages.
I used to work in the construction business. We used to build street curbs and other physically demanding jobs at very low costs. This is a service in itself. As a foreign national, I may be forced to accept 800,000 tumans for a chair, but an Iranian colleague and neighbor of mine wouldn't accept a job at that amount. I'll take very slim profit margins to let the wheels spin. Our growth has been weaker compared to our Iranian counterparts, but we've worked hard for it. I started work at 8 a.m. and finish at 10 p.m. With such dedication, you'll eventually grow.
Earlier in the day, that's closer to the Taliban takeover, 4,000 to 5,000 were reported to be making their way in from Afghanistan, negotiating dangerous routes for $500 to $600 per head with smugglers. Not everyone pays that much, but it's never a comfortable trip at times in car trunks into any city they can get to. Mr. Abedi is an expert on the matter. He joined us on Skype. Do listen in.
The most important opportunity Iran has provided for immigrants is their security. Unfortunately, security is a big regional issue, including in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Pakistan. Three countries with the most immigrants to Iran, which have imposed a heavy economic burden on the country. They enjoy such security that they engage in economic activities. Afghans especially have a remarkable presence in Iran's economic activities. So do Iraqis.
Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Today, nearly 6 million Afghans have been driven out of their homes and their country by conflict, violence and poverty, according to UN refugees. What's noticeable about Iran is that while 4% of refugees live in 20 settlements managed by the Interior Ministry's Bureau for Aliens and Foreign Immigrants Affairs, BAFIA, refugee populations are generally protracted here. That's to say, 96% of refugees live scattered among Iranians in cities, towns, and villages. What's also noteworthy is that children can now receive nationality even from an Iranian mother. That's not something you see everywhere in the world. Iran's is one of the longest and most protracted refugee situations in the world, beginning in 1979 due to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan.
The point is that granting citizenship can impose various costs on a country.